Funding for Think comes from SMU Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How well do you understand your cat? Cats have been beloved as pets for thousands of years, and these days there are three of them in the world for every dog. The fact that cats are so very familiar, though, makes it unfortunately easy to overlook their fascinating history and the remarkable things their bodies can do. John Bradshaw is here to talk about all that. He is Foundation Director of the Anthrozoology Institute at the University of Bristol and author of the new book, Cat Sense, How the New Feline Science Can Make You a Better Friend to Your Pet. He is on the line with us from the BBC studios in Southampton. John, welcome back to Think.
Good afternoon, Chris.
You speak up here as a sort of advocate for feline research, which thus far has not increased in the sort of astronomical way that canine research has. What accounts for the difference?
I think very simply that dogs are very easy to train. So people who want to find out more about how animals' minds work, the dog is actually almost an ideal subject. Previously, a lot of the work has been done with mice and rats and also with chimpanzees and other apes. But an increasing number of researchers are switching to dogs because they are very easy to work with. You don't have to keep them in a laboratory. You can just talk to owners and say, can you bring your dog along? And we'll give it a few tests. And many owners are happy to do that. So the sort of the studies of cognition in the dog have really taken off in a big way in the last decade. We know quite a lot about how cats think, but certainly they're not really very good subjects for that kind of work. So it has lagged behind a bit.
And you tell us here that cats still have, this is a quote, 3 out of 4 feet firmly planted in their wild origins. How and when were they first domesticated?
Well, the story of how cats were domesticated has kind of changed over the past few years with increasing evidence coming from their DNA. The DNA of domestic cats from all over the world has been compared with that of wild cats, again, from all over the world. They're the same species. They're all same species. They can interbreed. And the domestic cat was derived from the wild cat at some point. We used to think it probably happened in Egypt about 4,000 or 5,000 years ago. The date has now been put back to almost, well, in fact, a little bit more than double that, to something like 10,000 years ago, and probably somewhere else in the Middle East, not too far from Egypt, but perhaps a little bit further north in what is now Syria or Turkey.
So their behavior may have changed a bit since they've come to live with us, but I want first to talk about how their bodies have changed.
Their bodies are really remarkably similar to a wild cat. They develop very slightly differently. The mere fact that they get fed, our pet cats get fed on cat food, means that their stomachs grow in a very slightly different way to an animal like a feral cat or indeed a wild cat that has to go out hunting and eats a lot of roughage and fur and feathers and all that sort of thing. But apart from that, domestication, at least as far as your average alley cat is concerned, has changed their bodies remarkably little.
And their cats' diets are still highly dependent on meat. Why did they not adapt to the kinds of diets their owners were eating in the way that dogs did?
Well, dogs have a fairly standard kind of mammalian digestive system. I mean, we think of them as carnivores. We think of them as meat eaters. Their ancestors, the wolves, are hunting animals which live on meat a lot of the time. But in fact, in times of when meat is hard to find, wolves will quite easily switch to eating fruit and all sorts of things. And so as far as the dog's concerned, you know, you can feed them biscuits. They can get all the protein that they need from vegetable sources. And, you know, it's possible to design, perfectly reasonable to design a vegetarian dog food if that's the way that the owner wants it to be. I don't think the dogs care one way or the other, but, you know, it's possible. The cat is a very different animal. The whole cat family, in fact, are very different. Sometime in the very early evolution of the cat family, millions of years ago, the ancestral cat, which probably didn't look too different to the ones we have, the smaller cats we have today, lost the ability to digest anything really but meat. And indeed, they continue to need that today. The whole cat family, right from lions down to the smallest little tiny species that are smaller than the domestic cat, they all have this thing in common that they need meat in the diet. They can't switch over to carbohydrate. They need a fair amount of fat as well, but obviously from a hunting habit, if you just simply get all your food by hunting, you get that automatically. It isn't a problem to you. It's only a problem if you start scavenging off other animals, and that other animal, of course, these days is humans. We leave a lot of carbohydrate lying around, especially today, not so much protein. And so cats that scavenge do have a hard time of it. They have to really seek out bits of meat and fish to get a balanced diet. And that's why commercial cat food has to contain so much animal protein.
So why, when so many of us allow our cats to live sort of fat and happy in our homes and make sure they never miss a meal, why are they always hunting anyway?
Well, I think the reputation of the cat as being a hunter has been somewhat overplayed. I mean, certainly some of them do hunt and quite a lot. We've just done a study in a village in just outside London where there are about 100 cats. We were able to study 50 of them with their owner's cooperation. Out of those 50, during the course of a fortnight, a couple of weeks, we got about 40 or so items of prey. That's all the cats put together. And most of those were down to one cat. And that one cat turned out to have been a very unusual animal. It was born in Hong Kong, would you believe? Born on the streets and had lived on the streets of Hong Kong for probably a couple of years before it was rescued by its current owners, who then moved jobs, came back to the UK, brought this lovely cat, Orlando, with them. And he discovered a rabbit warren at the bottom of his owner's garden and basically makes the rabbit's lives somewhat difficult. But he, I think, is unusual. I mean, I think he typifies what actually has to happen as far as a cat is concerned. If they grow up in a very uncertain world where they don't know where their next meal is coming from, then they do teach themselves to hunt. In fact, mother cats will teach their kittens to hunt. If they themselves, the mothers, are good at it, then they can do that. So it depends an awful lot on the cat's upbringing. They do all possess that instinct to hunt, if they're brought up in homes with mothers who don't go out hunting, then they don't really get the habit and they don't do very much. They do a little bit, but it's not very serious. They don't eat generally what they catch. Modern cat food is much tastier than mice. So I think the danger to wildlife in many places is somewhat overplayed.
So how different, John, is the behavior and the sociability of feral cats that we might see in an alley somewhere and the ones that we might receive as kittens from a neighbor or friend?
Well, they're essentially identical animals, except for the upbringing that they've had. So a feral cat will be, generally speaking, quite wary of people. It will tend to run away if you get too close. And that's because that cat did not meet people and didn't meet nice people anyway, or people who are nice to it, during a very crucial period in the kitten's life, which is between 4 weeks and 8 weeks of age. If a kitten doesn't meet people and get stroked a little bit by people at some point during that time, then it kind of a switch gets turned in its brain and it really finds it incredibly difficult to accept people as friends forever after, the whole rest of its life. A little bit of gentle handling, even a few minutes during that period of time, will make the cat a little bit more trusting, and then even if it's only had a little bit of contact during that time, it will accept contact after that and gradually become more friendly. Of course, the majority of kittens that are born in somebody's home, if you're getting a kitten from a neighbour, will have automatically had lots of contact with people during that period of time, just because the mother cat's in the house and will allow the children and the family, the mother and the father and whoever, to pick up the kittens and stroke them. And so it's a natural automatic process, which basically socializes that kitten for the rest of its life.
So that socialization, it sounds like it's the difference between a cat that is sort of always around and wants to sit on your lap and the one that goes dashing out of the room whenever the front door opens.
Well, even within pet cats, you will get that kind of variation. So those would all be socialized animals. A feral cat wouldn't have come in the door in the first place. And there are indeed cats which are very wary of strangers. And this is to do with the kind of learning that they've had about people during kittenhood and subsequently, up to perhaps about 6 or 8 months or a year old. We're not quite sure, but it's certainly the first year of life is also important in determining the cat's personality. So some cats are naturally very outgoing, and therefore everyone they meet they will go up to and greet, and they will, provided those people are nice to the, back to the cat, will learn that human beings in general, whether they're male or female or children or adults or whatever, are generally good to be around. Other cats are perhaps genetically, naturally a little bit more nervous of new experiences, and so have to be coaxed a bit more into accepting people of different kinds. So you may get a cat that's one woman or one man cats that have really only got to know their owner, and they're perfectly happy with their owner. They may have a very affectionate relationship with their owner, but anyone who is not the owner, who looks different or smells different, is suspicious. And so those are the kind of cats that people say, "I've got a cat," and all their friends say, "No, you haven't, because we've never seen it." Those sorts of cats do exist, and they're not feral. They have just not had the right kind of life experiences, and they haven't got the right kind of personality. The kind of combination between the two has made them nervous of everyone but their owner.
It almost sounds like an oxymoron to ask this question, but what have we learned scientifically about the best ways to discipline a cat?
I think disciplining a cat is a very difficult thing to do. We can get away with it with dogs because they are so affectionate. They are so bonded to us that even if we inflict pain on them, and some dog training methods do inflict pain. I mean, the electric shock collars, for example. The dog will keep coming back to you because it is so bonded to you. Cats are affectionate animals, but the strength of that affection to people is not so strong. So if they realise that they're being punished by a human being, they very quickly come to dislike that person and keep away from them. So punishment as a method of training cats is really a non-starter, unless you can be absolutely sure that any kind of punishment is you don't want to hurt the cat. Who wants to hurt their cat? It's a ridiculous
sure.
idea. But if you do want to deter the cat from doing something, then you make absolutely sure that you're not around when it happens. So one of the tricks that people use, for example, is to get an old-fashioned spring-loaded mousetrap, put it upside down so it's not going to hurt anything, in a place where you don't want the cat to go. The cat goes along, knocks the mousetrap with its paw. The mousetrap just springs up in the air. It doesn't catch anything. But the noise and the surprise of this thing springing up in the air will make the cat a little bit, I shouldn't be going there. And, some people have apartments or houses where there are places which is dangerous for the cat to go. It's not possible to fence it off. And so, people grow houseplants that are poisonous for cats. Lilies, for example. You should never let a cat chew a lily. So if you want to deter your cats from eating lilies, that may be a way of doing it. The other way is a water pistol of some kind, but you must make sure the cat doesn't realise you're holding it. Hmm. Otherwise, it's you that. But a little bit of water in the face isn't going to hurt a cat for more than the microsecond. They just don't like water very much. So that will be okay. But other than that, you really shouldn't punish a cat at all, because it will make the cat dislike you.
My guest is John Bradshaw. He's Foundation Director of the Anthrozoology Institute at the University of Bristol and author of the new book, Cat Sense: How the New Feline Science Can Make You a Better Friend to Your Pet. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
We'll be right back.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this January to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in global studies, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is John Bradshaw. He's Foundation Director of the Anthrozoology Institute at the University of Bristol and author of the book Cat Sense, How the New Feline Science Can Make You a Better Friend to Your Pet. Join us by emailing think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372. John, what sort of social structure exists among feral cats, and what does that suggest about the way they might relate to one another as members of our households?
Maybe, Chris, if you don't mind, we could just return to that business of training very briefly before I talk about that. I don't want to give the impression that punishing cats is a good thing to do. I think occasionally it may be the only way to solve a particular thing the cat's doing. But what I think people don't realize enough is that cats are very trainable, and that you can train them using rewards. You should always train them using rewards, because that makes a cat like you more rather than less. For example, you can easily train a cat to like going into its cat carrier, the kind of battle that I think a lot of cat owners will relate to. Getting the cat to the vet for its vaccinations can be a real struggle. If the cat has been trained by putting food treats in the carrier beforehand and knows that not only that the carrier exists, but that it's a good place to be, you can make that trip to the veterinarian a whole lot better for yourself and your cat. And there are a whole lot of other things you can do to train a cat with, but the best way is to use food rewards or sometimes games or stroking. Some cats will prefer those, but a tasty treat like some prawns or something usually works pretty well with most cats.
Should we invite them into that carrier occasionally when we're not going to the vet or somewhere?
Absolutely, yes. Yeah, I mean, before you ever think about taking before the cat's first trip to the veterinarian is the best place to start. You know, you don't think about getting the cat carrier out, but get the cat carrier out, put it in the living room, let the cat investigate it. I mean, it's a paradox, really, isn't it, that they hate going in cat carriers, but you get a cardboard carton back from the grocery store and put it on the floor, and the first thing is the cat goes and sits in it. There must be, thousands of internet pictures of cats doing exactly that. And so you might ask yourself, why do they not do that to the cat carrier? And their answer is because the cat carrier is associated with getting picked up, put in a car, which cats don't understand, taking the veterinarian, which may be a little uncomfortable for them. They have bad memories of that. So the trick is to get it out first before anything is, just leave it lying around with the door open. Lead a little trail of maybe biscuits up to it or something so that the cat goes in, has a look around, feed some tasty treats through the little slots in the side that are there for, to let the air in. So the cat really feels this is a fine place to be. And then if you've done that a few times, then the next time when you need to take it to the veterinarian, the cat will probably just walk in. You can shut the door behind it. You can also do some training to help the cat learn that being carried around in this thing is okay as well, and make that the first stages anyway, that trip to the veterinarian, much more pleasant for the cat, and as I said, much easier for you as well, especially if you've only got 10 minutes till the appointment.
Okay, back to the question, and thank you for that, because I think that extra information was great. Back to the question of cat society. How do they relate to one another when we're not around?
Well, cats are, it's a fascinating subject, really, because cats in the wild, the wild ancestors, the Arabian wild cat was probably the ancestor. We don't know a huge amount about its behavior, but we do know it's a very solitary animal, never seen in groups, never seen even in families, apart from a mother with some fairly young dependent kittens. That's the biggest group you'll get, and you don't see males and females together, you don't see adult females together. If we switch, so we're only 10,000 years of evolution, which is a very, blink of an eye in evolutionary terms. We now see female cats in particular cooperating when they're given the opportunity to do it. And that might be in a feral colony. It might just be at a breeder's where somebody who has several breeding female cats will find that those cats will help one another out if they have kittens at a similar time, which, of course, is what happens in the wild. It's a seasonal thing. They'll have a litter of kittens in the spring. What usually happens is that one female will have a litter. The females, the female offspring. The male offspring tend to leave, but the female offspring will still be around the following year. They'll now be old enough to breed. They'll have some kittens of their own, and everybody helps everybody else. Sisters and mother all help, so you get some grandmothering going on. And that's how very often a colony of feral cats builds up. And they do. They suckle one another's kittens. They don't seem to discriminate between their own and those of their sisters or their mother or their daughters. They'll bring any prey or food they bring back to the nest before the kittens are old enough to leave it. They'll share around among the kittens. They'll spend a lot of time together, not just when they're breeding, but at other times of year as well, hanging out together, grooming one another, rubbing on one another, raising their tails when they talk to one another. The males are not so sociable, I have to say. They're very definitely a matriarchy, feral cat society. And it's something which seems to have appeared out of thin air during the course of domestication. It's something that's enabled cats to live in much higher densities than they could have done in the wild. And that, of course, has enabled them to exploit the kind of food that we've provided, both just accidentally, because we grow mice, so to speak, by mistake, and also more recently by providing them deliberately with food.
Well, at least among the females, that sounds delightful. Why is that so hard for so many people who have one cat and bring another into the house to replicate?
Well, the first thing is that it's a bit like human families. We kind of tend to stick around with our relatives, but there's always one you don't get on with. And so a family, especially of female cats, and you can include neutered males in that, provided the males don't become mature, they tend to stay, they are accepted by the females and by each other. It's only once the males actually mature and start spraying and trying to chase females around that they get kicked out and become solitary. So a male cat that's neutered up to about the age of 6 months. Let's just treat that as if it's a female. So if they're related, they will tend to get on. It isn't automatic, just as I said, just as with human families. Sometimes you'll get people who've done, I think, which is the ideal thing to do, which is get a brother and a sister or two sisters or two brothers from the same litter, keep them together, and by about the end of the first year, they've gone off from one another, and they don't really get on at all. They lead separate lives, and I think that's just being cats. Cats are ultimately social animals, and they may revert to that. But most times, cats from the same litter or cats that have grown up together, maybe mother and daughter or mother and son or something like that, will carry on being friendly for pretty much for the rest of their lives. So that's good for people who want to set out to get two cats straight off. That, of course, is not everyone's situation. People who want to get a second cat, having got one, I don't think they should do that for the reason of giving the cat company. Most cats are happy with the company of their owners and are not craving the company of other cats. But let's say that people want to do that, and that's a fine thing to want to do, especially to give an unwanted cat or kitten a home. But the introduction needs to be managed very carefully. And the way to do it is to, first of all, introduce the cats to one another's smells, because that's how cats tell one another apart. They don't use faces like we do. The main way that they will tell one cat from another is by what it smells like. So the simple trick is to get a couple of pieces of cloth, rub one on one cat, rub one on the other cat that's maybe still in the rehoming centre, switch the pieces of cloth over so that each cat gets to smell the other one. Do that a few times, and each cat will learn that there is another cat around and what it smells like, so we'll kind of know who it is in the general sense of being able to identify it, and that it isn't a threat. I mean, the piece of cloth hasn't done anything. It hasn't jumped up and bitten them or run away from them or anything, as a real cat would. So you can get the idea into both cats' heads that there is another cat around that smells like this, but it isn't a threat. Then you can actually bring the cat home so that the two cats are in the same house, same building, but keep them apart for the time being. Keep switching the scents around. Keep them being able to see one another but not get at one another, and just take the whole process very slowly and gently. The thing to do is to avoid getting to the point where one cat actually runs away and hides from the other, because that can be a difficult point to get back from. So if it looks as though that might be going to happen, close the door between the cats or whatever and try again the next day. But if it's done gradually, most cats will learn to, at the very least, tolerate one another, and many of them will actually grow up to be very fond of one another.
John Bradshaw is with us. His new book is called Cat Sense. Our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. And on the line now we have Jerry in Ferris. Hi, Jerry.
Hi.
Hello, go right ahead, please.
I have two wonderful cats that were born from a feral mom out in our barn. We live out in the country, so we have a lot of room to roam. And they're brothers. They're about 4.5 now. And probably about when they were maybe 6 months old, we had another male cat in the home at the time, and they got along great with him. But he had a medical issue, and he started to pee in the sinks or in corners. So we knew that there was a problem, and we took him to the vet. But the other two cats, the two younger cats, started to pee in the sinks as well, and they never stopped. If we let them outside at night, they won't pee in the house. But if they're inside for a full 24 hours, then one of them will pee in the sinks. And we really decided this was the only way that we could keep the cats, is to let them outside at night. And their mother trained them to, I mean, she brought the mice when we had them in, you know, a safe place for them to help them learn to hunt, and they're both great hunters. But I wonder if, is it just a male cat thing, or is it because they, you know, were from a more wild environment?
Any thoughts on that, John?
Have all the three of these males, have they all been fixed? They've all been neutered, have they?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, there is a bit of an issue, I think, with bringing a number of male cats together, even if they've all been fixed. And basically, there are two things. One is that they will start to urinate indoors, partly to relieve stress from because they want to scent mark their environment. If each cat, and I think initially it must have been your older male cat, began to feel threatened by the two younger ones, maybe feeling that they were going to try to take over what he perceived as his house, then he would have started just to mark using his urine in the house to try and deter them. Of course, that didn't work because it's you, the owner, who are determining where the cats go. But that's, you know, the cats are behaving in a way, the way they used to, if you like, when they were masters of their own destiny and could tell the others to go away. There's also an element, I think, here of potential a medical problem that you referred to in the older cat, where it's now known, it may not have been at the time you had this problem, but it's now becoming increasingly clear to veterinarians that a lot of these urinary problems, and cystitis in particular, which sounds as if is one of the problems your cat had, are actually made much worse by stress. And that carving up the house in some way between the cats, so that each one has a safe place, if you like, that the other cats can't get to, quite often relieves the symptoms. And so the cat stops having difficulty in urinating and all that sort of thing. So cystitis in cats, I think in general, it's worth noting, is not only a medical issue. It's not just caused by an infection or something. It's quite closely related to issues of stress and the way the cat is feeling, as well as any kind of medical cause.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Next on the line is Gloria in Arlington. Hello, Gloria.
Hello. There seems to be a debate over which is more intelligent, cats or dogs. I recently read that cats are more intelligent, only that they don't get the credit because they're not as obedient as dogs. Is that correct or incorrect?
It's difficult to compare intelligence between animals because they've got the minds they need to do the job that they were built to do. I think that's so. Dogs are very intelligent as far as communicating with people are concerned. I mean, they are the best animal that there is in terms of communicating with people. They're better than their ancestor, the wolf. They're better than chimpanzees, who we think of as being, you know, the smartest animals apart from humans that there are. If you compare a dog to a chimpanzee in terms of how much human body language they understand, the dog wins virtually every time. So that's the dog's intelligence, if you like. They're incredibly well tuned to us. And of course, that's why they're so easy to train. They want to learn from us. They're very tuned into everything we're doing. Cats are more independent animals, and so their intelligence is focused more on themselves. So, you know, if you want to make an analogy with humans, you could say cats have a more selfish kind of intelligence. But of course, you could say that dogs' intelligence is selfish because it gets them what they need, which is which is human company and a good place to live. I think cats are less socially intelligent than dogs are. They don't understand people so well, and they don't understand other animals as well. But they do, for example, understand the relationships between each other and the scent markings that they leave behind. They are actually probably capable of identifying more other cats by their smells than dogs can, other dogs by their smells. So it's a slightly strange analogy, but it's horses for courses, if you like. I know it's a wrong animal, but you know, the time that animals have the intelligence they need for the kind of lifestyle they have.
Let's go back to the phones now, and this time we have Kara on the line in Fort Worth. Hi, Kara.
Hi, I was calling because we have a 14-year-old cat, and on Friday we are introducing a dog into our household, and she has never been very friendly with other cats and has never been interested in dogs or scared of them, and I was wondering how can we introduce the two in a way where, you know, she may not feel betrayed.
Okay. Well, I don't think she'll feel betrayed. I think betrayal is, kind of a sophisticated emotion. I think she may well feel scared, or at least slightly anxious, because cats, you know, do value your home as much as they value you, in a way that a dog doesn't. Dogs value you, and then your home is where you happen to live. And if you move home, the dog moves with you and doesn't have a problem. Whereas cats, of course, do have a problem when you move home, and that's why you need to keep them in for a while after you move home. Otherwise, they try and go back to your old home. So I think if you were listening a little earlier to what I was saying about introducing two cats together, I don't see why that shouldn't work with a cat and a dog. That if you introduce, both animals are very focused on smell, so if you introduce them to each other's smells first and then very gently to each other's physical presence, I think that should work fine.
John Bradshaw is with us. He is Foundation Director of the Anthrozoology Institute at the University of Bristol and author of the new book, Cat Sense, How the New Feline Science Can Make You a Better Friend to Your Pet. We'll resume our conversation in a couple of minutes. You can join us by emailing think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this January to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in global studies, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with anthrozoologist John Bradshaw about his new book, Cat Sense, How the New Feline Science Can Make You a Better Friend to Your Pet. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. John, describe for us, if you will, the differences in how cats sense the world as compared with how we sense the world, because they have really keen abilities to smell things, to hear things, to see things in the dark.
Yes, the two worlds overlap, obviously. Otherwise, we wouldn't be able to communicate with each other. But there are significant differences between them. Their eyes, you can see just by looking at a cat, you can just see how big their eyes are. In fact, their eyes are almost the same size as a person's eyes, but of course in a much smaller skull. So that gives you some clues as to what they're used for. They're used indeed for seeing, not in the dark, nothing can see in the dark, but in very low light levels indeed, dusk and dawn and during a moonlit night, a cat can see pretty well when we would stumble around and fall over. And that means that they're not very good at actually seeing in bright sunlight. You notice that cats actually find bright sunlight quite uncomfortable, and they'll screw their eyes up, and they have to contract their eyes to a slit. They can't actually bring them down to a point like we can. It's the eye is just too big. And they don't see in colour, or at least if they see some kind of slightly washed out colours, but they don't really seem to pay much attention to colour. They see outlines and they see movement much more crucially than we do. They're not kind of relaying TV pictures like our eyes are. They're seeing things moving around. And as I said, not so much in bright light. They don't tend to use their vision in bright light. And also the other problem with having a huge eye like that is that it can't be focused very well. And so they're actually very quite long-sighted. And that's why they have those very long and mobile sensitive whiskers at the front of the face. So when they're needing to find out about something that's literally in front of their noses, they'll swing those whiskers forwards and just touch it to find out exactly what shape and size it is. Vision, it's slightly similar to ours, but I think we have to acknowledge that it's different as well. Hearing, they can hear everything we can hear, and then a whole lot more besides, because their hearing goes right up into what we call ultrasound, the sort of squeaky noises that bats make. And crucially, because I don't think many cats prey on bats, but crucially, mice, the noises mice make, and indeed the hearing range of mice is above ours. It's all up in what we call the ultrasound. And cats can detect mice by the little squeaks they make to each other, which we can barely hear. They're quite loud to a cat, and so that helps them, or it used to help them in hunting. But I think the sense where they really differ from us in a major way is the senses of smell, because there are actually two. There's the conventional sense of smell, where they sniff things through their noses, and everybody kind of thinks, dogs are incredibly sensitive smell, and of course we make use of that. We use sniffer dogs to find explosives and drugs and all kinds of things. But every dog has that very sensitive nose. Cats are not quite, they're probably 10 times less good as dogs, which is still 1,000 times better than us. So there's a lot of stuff going on in the environment that they can smell that there is we're completely oblivious to. And then on top of that, or rather underneath that, between the nostrils and the roof of their mouth, they've got another olfactory organ, another smell apparatus, which is normally just is dormant. It just sits there. It's connected to the roof of the mouth and to the nostrils by little tubes, which if you've got a very friendly cat that'll let you pull its mouth open and have a look, just behind the little grooming teeth at the front, at the top of the mouth, are two little slits, which are the openings of this wonderful thing, which is what they use for sniffing, particularly sniffing other cats' smells. So if a cat has rubbed up against a twig in your garden, or a fence post or the post by your back door, and your cat comes along and sniffs it, it will do this funny grimace thing where they pull their top lips up. And what that's doing is bringing this other nose, the second nose, into focus, drawing odour up from the mouth into this thing, which then analyses the smell in as well as the nose itself analyzing it. And the two sets of information are actually passed initially to different parts of the brain, and then the brain connects the two together and kind of combines the information. And the whole cat family does it. You can see lions doing it in the zoo, this curling top lip grimace when they sniff another lion. And quite a lot of our dogs will do it, but it's much less obvious. So and in this case, the dog is inferior to the cat. The cat outperforms the dog. It seems to be probably 100 times more sensitive at social smells than the dog is. So cats, they don't just live down there at ankle level, which, is obviously they do. But what they're picking up on is a whole load of information that is completely foreign to us. We have no idea what that world smells like. But to a cat, that's the most important thing about it.
We know, of course, John, that the old saw about cats having nine lives is nonsense, but they do seem to get out of a lot of scrapes that would be fatal to other animals, you know, things like falls and climbing up really high. What accounts for that? Is it just their great sense of balance?
Most of it, yeah. I mean, some of it's to do with their kind of, they're quite sensible animals. You know, dogs will kind of rush into a situation. You know, act first, think last. Whereas cats are the other way around. They're more circumspect. They very often pull back from situations where another more risky animal would perish. So that's part of it. They're just rather sensible. But they're physically very well set up to survive tumbling off something. So that they do walk along the tops of fences very well. Part of that is because they are very agile. They don't have a collarbone. You know, we have fairly rigid shoulders connected together with a collarbone at the front, as well as the shoulder joints at the back. Well, in the cat, the collarbone isn't there, and so they can actually basically place one shoulder in front of another when they're walking along the top of something very narrow. So that helps. They use their tails to balance, so that helps as well. And then if they do slip, if all the agility that they have and the good balance they have doesn't work out for them and they do actually slip, they are very good at twisting over in midair. And it's been a puzzle that is actually, I think it's actually in kind of high school physics now, how does a cat turn itself over in midair? Because, you know, your eye would not really know what to do. But they can do it by pulling their legs in and sticking them out at the appropriate moments. They can actually twist around. They can, you know, they can almost claw at the air and pull themselves around. And not actually doing that, they're using their balance to do it. And then extend their legs, and they're very elastic skeletons enable them to land. And if they do fall a long way, you know, if a cat is unlucky enough to fall out of an apartment building 4 or 5 stories up, they actually have time to parachute, and they'll do the sort of flying fox thing where they'll actually stretch their legs out, and the skin that connects their legs to their belly is then deployed almost as a parachute, and that'll help to slow them down a bit as well. And then obviously they prepare themselves for landing by arching their back, so there's a maximum elasticity there. And so cats can survive and have been known to survive really falls which would kill certainly a human, but also many other animals too.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to Jill in Arlington. Hi, Jill.
Hi. My question, I would like the author's feelings on the pretty active movement in this country on feral cat populations, which is to catch them, neuter them, and then release them back into their colonies with the idea that this is going to somehow help control the feral cat population. I've read studies about the billions of birds that are killed by not just feral cats, but domestic cats that are allowed to roam at night and whatever. And I've had the experience in my backyard when I lost 3 cardinal babies.
Well, what do you think about all that, John?
Well, it's as your caller rightly says, it's a very hot topic at the moment. It's not just in the United States. It's particularly in Australia and New Zealand, where, of course, the cat is a more alien animal than it is in America. I mean, it is an alien animal in America. There were no equivalent wild cats in America until domestic cats came over in the sort of 15th, 16th century. So American wildlife maybe hasn't had the time to adjust to these animals as predators. I think, first of all, it's important to make a distinction between well-kept pet cats that have initially that have been born to mothers that didn't hunt. I think because a lot of this hunting prowess is something that is not instinctive. It's something that they have to learn. If a kitten is not taught by its mother how to hunt and is well fed and doesn't really need to go out hunting, it will go out. Yes, it will look around. It may even bring one or two birds or mice back. But the research shows that what these cats are bringing back are animals which were pretty close to passing away anyway. You know, most of these small animals breed like crazy, and a lot of them do. It's a sad fact that a lot of them do die, and if they didn't die, we would be overrun by them. Cats are not really, there's no real evidence, I think, that they're they're except in places like Australia and New Zealand, which are a different kind of situation, they're not really contributing. Pet cats are not really contributing to certainly to extinctions or even local population problems. Feral cats are a very different matter. They will tend to be animals which have learned to hunt. Their mothers will have been good hunters and so will have taught them. They therefore carry on that habit even if they're being fed quite well. I think some people just advocate exterminating them. Let's poison them, trap them, shoot them, whatever, and then they'll go away. And I think the fact is that they don't. Feral cats breed very fast. And so if you do exterminate them from an area, experience says that they will be back within a year or two in the same sort of numbers. So it's a short-term solution. The idea of the trap, neuter and release that you described is a way of blocking that return, if you like, that you put the cats back. They can't breed anymore, so they can't increase in numbers. But they do prevent other cats from coming in and exploiting whatever it is, whatever the food source is. I mean, cats cannot exist without a source of food. They're not terribly good hunters. They will be being fed by people to some extent. If there are a lot of feral cats around, you can guarantee there's somebody feeding them. So there's a whole host of, I think, of solutions that need to be looked at, that trying to persuade people not to feed them so much, that to adopt the kittens, to manage the colony until it eventually dies out. If the food source is removed, then the cats won't come back. But usually there is somebody around who feels very sorry for the cats and is feeding them, or there is an insecure food dumpster or something like that, which the cats are exploiting. Without food, they won't persist. And I think that's, it needs a proper, sensible and continuous management solution. You can't just go in, neuter and return and then walk away, because you'll be back to square one within a year or two. And that's certainly been shown by the studies done in the UK and elsewhere.
John, the last time you were here, we talked about dog sense. I wonder if you have come to any kind of understanding of why, although this may be a false dichotomy, but why in the world there are people who feel they are dog people and people who feel they are cat people?
Well, some of it is, I think, is just down to personal preference and experience. There are people who, I think, like dogs because dogs do what they tell them to do or what they would like them to do. And I think that's a perfectly reasonable relationship to have with an animal. And of course, it can be a working relationship, or it can be like a working relationship. So people who keep dogs because they like to go out hunting, and the dog is part of that enjoyment and part of that hobby. And if the dog wasn't obedient, of course, it wouldn't be worth taking the dog out. It would get in the way. It would spoil whatever you're doing. So having an obedient dog around when you're doing something like that, I think, is all part of the enjoyment. Cats, again, I think they appeal to a slightly different kind of aspect of human nature. That I feel particularly that I respect cats because they are somewhere between a wild animal and a fully domesticated animal. I mean, dogs are about as domesticated as you can possibly get. They don't look like wolves. They don't behave like wolves. They don't think like wolves. And a good thing, too, of course. But cats have still got that element of wildness about them, which is something that we've encouraged over the centuries. We've encouraged them to be hunters. And that's why for most of their 10,000 years of co-history with us, they have been our protectors against mice and rats and other animals that would otherwise have caused all sorts of damage to our food supplies. So I think it is a little unfair of us to suddenly expect them to, okay, we don't want you to hunt anymore, we don't like that anymore, just give it up. The cats aren't really listening, unfortunately. I think that's, we need to have a little sympathy with them in that sense. But ultimately, I think they just appeal to different kinds of people.
John Bradshaw is Foundation Director of the Anthrozoology Institute at the University of Bristol and author of Cat Sense: How the New Feline Science Can Make You a Better Friend to Your Pet. John, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much for making time for us.
Not at all.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Our podcast is produced by Christine McConnell. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer, and Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can download the podcast at kera.org/think and send comments to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.